Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, everybody. This is Silvio Canto in Dallas, Texas, on Thursday, February the 2nd. Today, we're going to be chatting with our good friend, Barry Jacobson. We're going to take a look at national security. From time to time, we like to do that with Barry, check out some of the hot spots around the world. There are a couple of them. There could be a few more. One of the big news of the week is that Iran, or the Trump administration, put Iran on notice, as General Flynn said a couple of days ago. And this has something to do with a missile test that Iran conducted a couple of days ago or earlier, a few days ago, well, whatever the time frame. And they decided, the Trump administration decided to send a message to Iran, basically saying, we're not going to play this game anymore. This is a different president, a different reaction. Exactly what that means, we're going to find out today. I'd like to hear what Barry has to say about it. There have also been military operations in Yemen. In the last few days of the Obama administration, there were operations in Somalia as well. The operation to take back the city of Mosul continues in Iraq. Barry's going to talk to us a little bit about a tank war with Russia. Very fascinating topic. And then we're going to talk about this Saudi Arabian ship that was attacked. And I think the consensus is that the people who attacked it thought it was an American ship. And what does that mean? What does that mean for the region? So lots and lots of national security items this week. Let me say hello to our good friend Barry Jacobson. How are you, Barry?
I am well, Silvio. How are you?
Not too bad. You know, from time to time, I like to take just a detour from our World War II episodes. We'll get back to it next week. But I wanted to just kind of chat with you a little bit today about what is going on in the world. I'm not saying that it's completely out of control, but there are some things to look at. Iran, Yemen, Somalia, Iraq, this tank war with Russia. You got me intrigued about that. That is really interesting, that article that you sent to me. And, of course, the Saudi Arabia ship that was attacked, we believe they thought they were hitting us, as you indicated in your message to me. So where would you like to start? There's a lot on the table. Which of these topics do you want to go with first?
You know, the Chinese have a saying, may you be cursed to live in interesting times. You know, you and I, couple of weeks we talk, and we wonder if this could be nothing to talk about. But there never seems to be a lack of interesting things to talk about.
But, you know, the Chinese, if the Chinese were doing a radio show, they would say something like that, but about a radio show. They would say, may you be cursed with too many topics to cover on a national security show. I tell you what, I'll put one on the table first, just because I think this is fascinating, and I'm dying to hear your reaction to this. A couple of days ago, General Flynn came out in the middle of the routine press conference, you know, that Spicer does every day now. He came out and he basically said Iran is on notice. And, you know, I kind of like that. I think that's a good thing to hear. What did that mean to you, Barry? What did you interpret here?
Well, it was deliberately vague. It was deliberately left vague. And that's actually what you want. You want a little strategic, what they call strategic ambiguity in your messaging to your enemies or adversaries. One of the problems we had with the Obama administration was they telegraphed everything they were going to do and really more importantly what they weren't going to do. You don't want to tell – if you're a boxer going in the ring, you don't want to tell your opponent, I'm going to hit you with the left, I'm going to hit you with the right, but I'm not going to use any right or left hooks. There's all going to be jabs. Well, then your opponent knows exactly what he has to defend against. And if his weakest area is the hook, then he knows he has really little to worry about. And that's what Obama did for 8 years. When you take any option off the table prematurely, there's a time to take options off, and it's usually after negotiations. But before that, if you take off the table, well, you just handicap yourself. So what Trump is doing here, and I think General Flynn was communicating this, is that all the nonsense you and I have talked about that Iran has been up to for years, whether it's taking our sailors in international waters. Let's ignore the fact that sailors had stupid orders not to fire on the enemy, which I still can't fathom. Or firing missiles a couple weeks ago at our ships. We had another missile attack a few weeks back on one of our ships in roughly the same area that the ship last week was attacked, the Saudi ship. The missiles were intercepted by one of our interceptor systems and shot down. They did no damage, but they tried. And they've been doing things like this, as you know, for years. And what Trump is, I think, signaling, Silvio, is that we're no longer going to pretend it's not happening.
Right.
Obama ignored it because of the missile deal, the nuclear deal with Iran. And I think he let everything else slide because he didn't want to upset the Iranians in the backing out of those negotiations. What Trump is saying is anything's on the table. You're on notice, pal. We're not going to ignore what you've been doing.
Yeah. And it's about time, as you indicated, because the relationship with Iran, I mean, when you take American sailors in the high seas and then humiliate them on a video, that comes pretty close to an act of war with me. I mean, I don't know what else you do to provoke a superpower than something like that. I thought the humiliation of those young men and women on the video, I thought that was a step over the line. And we didn't react to that, and I thought that was very shameful. But I think you've got to like the article that I have hopefully coming out tomorrow at American Thinker. I'm tying all of this to Groundhog Day, which is today.
Which is
and
today.
I'm saying that the Trump groundhog came out and didn't like Iran's shadow. So that's
right.
That's my post for tomorrow. Hopefully,
well, I look forward to reading that. I look forward to that. You know, the point is a good one, which is that Iran is has been a bully in that neighborhood for a long time. And much like a big, dumb giant. You know, I remember in school we had a kid who was really large, probably, you know, 5 years larger than most of the kids in fifth grade. He easily could have been a high school kid. And he was a little bit dumpy, a little bit overweight, out of shape. I think looking back now, he probably had autism, but they were just undiagnosed in those days. And little teeny kids who were just mean little bullies would constantly pick on him because it gave them street cred to pick on the big kid bigger than himself. And they knew they could do it with impunity because he wasn't going to hit back. He was just a gentle giant. And in fact, one of the things I did as a kid myself is I would fight these bullies on his behalf. Because I despise bullies. By the way, I never lost a fight. And so, you know, Iran under Obama was the little bully, and we were the big dumb giant, taking every kick in the shin that they could deliver. And Trump, you know, Trump's not like that. He will use whatever means he thinks is necessary, and he's got very good advisors like General Mattis to lay out exactly what his options are. And to make sure those options are achievable. That's, of course, every part of every military plan is it's A, got to be practical and achievable, and B, it's got to lead to the results that you want to see achieved. And I think what we need to do is we need to knock Iran back on its heels, because clearly they're challenging the new president. They want to see if he's all talk, all bluster, and if they can bully him. And I think they're going to be surprised.
Right. Well, I think every once in a while, as you were saying with the example of the kid in school, every once in a while, I always think of, you know, remember that movie, the Christmas Story, the one that comes out every Christmas with Ralphie and the rifle?
Yes.
Remember that movie? Well,
sure.
One of my favorite scenes out of that movie, there's that bully who keeps pushing his little brother around. And finally, Ralphie's had it with the bully and just beats the crap out of him. And he even does more than he thought he could do. But the point is that I think every once in a while, you just got to beat the crap out of a bully and just remind him that you're not going to put up with it, that, you know, you have enough self-respect, you're not going to put up with what he's doing. And for me personally, Barry, we talked about this, I think, last year in one of our shows. I think the point they really crossed the line is when they took those sailors and humiliated them on the video. You know, it's one thing for these boats to come around you, and you know they're not really harming you. They're just showing you off, but they're not really harming you. But when you do that to soldiers and you put it on video, for me that was the point where you say, "That's it. We're not putting up with it anymore. We're going to go out and blow up a couple of your ships or do something." You know, that's the and you know if nothing else, if they get the message that there will be consequences. We may not even have to do anything, Barry, because just the message alone may be enough to deter any future activity. Sometimes just the message we'll get the message across, Barry.
Yeah, that's a good point. There's a couple things going on, and I want to unpack what you just said and talk about it. First, let's talk about taking our sailors and an act of war. If you remember, the very first war we ever fought as a nation was against the Barbary pirates. These were Islamic extremists of their day. They were various Emirites along the North African coast, and they made their living off piracy. And when they started seizing American ships and American seamen, never naval personnel until actually we got into war when we lost to Philadelphia. But for the most part, before the war began, they were grabbing merchants. No one had ever grabbed an American naval ship like that in those days. Of course, it's happened since. But that is an act of war. That is by definition an act of war. We could have declared war and had complete causae belli to do so, which means cause of war in Latin, and be completely justified. So the next time they do something like that, I'm not going to predict this. There's really no way I could predict this, but I would hope that Donald Trump would use that as a causae bellum to smack the Iranians very hard on the nose. If you ever had a really annoying dog that keeps putting his nose in your crotch, eventually right. You smack him on the nose and he withdraws. He doesn't do that anymore. You know, right. And that's what we knew. We need to smack him hard on the nose. And I can tell you a couple ways we can do this. The Iranian gunboats that are constantly buzzing our ships in the Gulf of Yemen are carrying out mock attacks. And by the way, the attack on the Saudi ship by Houthi rebels off Yemen, right there at the mouth of the Red Sea, was conducted much like the attack on the coal. It was a small boat with a suicide bomb attached. It blew up next to that ship and killed two sailors. It could have been a lot worse. It could have actually put a hole in the side and caused the ship to either sink or be badly damaged. That could happen to one of our ships in the Gulf. The Iranian gunboats are constantly buzzing us. One of those could be a suicide bomb. We don't know that. They could have torpedoes on board. They could launch torpedoes at close range. It is certainly within international law and norms to warn them off, and if they don't back off, to open fire on them. And I'd like to see Donald Trump do that. I'd like to see the Navy given orders the next time they buzz our ships with their swift boats, that we sink a couple of swift boats. If they want to escalate it further, we can do more. For instance, their refinery, they have a single oil refinery on the coast. That's all the refinery capability Iran has as a nation. It's with an easy strike distance of a cruise missile. We should take that out. That would damage their economy immensely. We could also mine their naval harbors if we want to take it to another level. We could also go in there and within about 2 weeks sink every boat in the Iranian Navy. We have a lot of options when it comes to dealing with Iran that we have not exercised yet, and I would like to see us exercise.
I think so, because I think, I understand that he was sending a message, and I understand the message was, as you say, vague, and that's a good thing. You don't want to tip your hand. But I think that it got to a point that they were, as you say, you know, just provoking, and I think it's time to do something in return and have them pay some kind of a consequence so that they understand that we mean what we say. I have a feeling with people like President Trump and General Mathis and General Flynn that they mean what they say. I certainly would not test them if I was Iran, because I don't think these guys are going to be pushed around at all. But, you know, we will see. Before we take a break, because we've got about a few other things, I want to take a couple minutes and talk about something that is not completely current events, but you being in California might be able to explain to me what happened at Berkeley last night. I kind of came into the story. I saw the what was going on at the UC Berkeley, and I saw all of the, all of the damage that was being done. Thankfully, no one was hurt that I know of. There was a lot of property damage, but nobody was hurt. The question I kept coming up with, Barry, was where are the authorities here? Where is the National Guard? Where is the police? Did they ever show up, Barry?
No, they didn't. They were told by the mayor of, as I understand, I talked to our friend Leslie Eastman, who is investigating this story for Legal Insurrection. And I talked to her today about this, and she told me that her investigation so far has revealed that the mayor of Oakland and the authorities of Berkeley both agreed not to send in the police to break it up, but to let it basically run its course. This, of course, is exactly what's been going on throughout the country, where you see these riots breaking out frequently by the left, and with the exception of Washington, D.C., where the during the inauguration, the day before the inauguration, police mostly don't rush in there and force and break these things up. They let them run their course, sort of let them burn them out. And then let the store owner who had his store destroyed worry about recovering the cost later. It's a despicable policy, mostly conducted by Democratic mayors, because most of these cities are controlled by Democrats, especially Berkeley, especially Oakland. I think that was the problem. They were told not to go in there, and of course it got out of hand. Now, these are the same anarchists, by the way, in Berkeley, who you saw at basically every other, riot in the last 5 years. They're the masks over their face, the black box anarchists. Many of them are funded by George Soros. Various organizations fund these guys that get money from Soros. It's part of a concerted effort to destabilize this country. And its allies are the far left of every stripe, including Hollywood, including left-wing journalists. I mean, Sarah Silverman, a Hollywood liberal, she's a comedian and sometimes actress, actually called for a military coup against Donald Trump, just yesterday. This is incredible language. By the way, the comedian who was not comedian, the lecturer that was going to come on at Berkeley and talk, he was invited by the Young Republicans, Milo Yiannopoulos, is a flamboyantly gay British conservative, which is a very weird combination. But he's extremely effective at mocking the left, and they absolutely despise him. And because he was a supporter of Trump, that's why these riots broke out.
Yeah. Well, see, I have when I was watching this and I kept, as I said, I didn't watch it the whole night. I'm glad that Leslie has been following this. When we have her on, we can talk about this, and I'm sure she'll be writing something about it soon. Because I kept, the part that I saw, I kept looking at it and saying, where are the authorities here? These people are conducting massive destruction. Certainly, if I was one of the students at Berkeley, that didn't make me feel real good. That people could do that and put my life at harm and put other people's lives in harm. And I think that mayors or police chiefs, probably mayors in this case, who do stuff like that, they're not being responsible. They're not, the oath of a mayor is like the oath of a president or governor. I mean, you have to protect the people. And you're not protecting people when you allow these things to happen. I will say one last thing about this, Barry, and I'd like to get your reaction to this, but I think when you don't come down hard on these kinds of anarchists, you're just encouraging more of it, Barry.
Well, that's exactly right. You're telling them that they can get away with this. And, it's fun to burn stuff. It's fun to destroy things if you're that kind of person who enjoys that, and there are some that do. So you're encouraging them to recruit. You're encouraging them to come out in larger force next time. Keep in mind, you and I can both remember 1968 and how America burned throughout that year,
yes,
with riots all over the country, and it resulted in the election of Richard Nixon, who was a law and order candidate. Donald Trump ran on the same platform, so I don't think that this is going to last very long. I have a strong suspicion, and it's I want to say this without sounding hysterical, but I think the left could well bring about much of what they fear in Trump. They could bring about a situation where Trump reacts very strongly, and they get a backlash that will end up being much what they fear, which is at least a temporary police state. Now, I'm not saying a police state in the sense that they're knocking on our doors, but where basically the authorities come down very, very hard on these people, and probably they should.
It's about time, because when you're engaging in this kind of behavior, you're potentially hurting people. If maybe there were some people hurt last night, I don't know the details, but you're putting a lot of things. I mean, when you're playing with fire and doing stuff like that, you could potentially hurt, perhaps even kill people. And I just think that at some point in time, you have to stop it. And I will say one last thing, Barry. If they think that this is actually, if this is helping their cause, I think it's having the exact opposite effect. I think this is making Trump even stronger. Because when any rational human being watching what they were doing last night, I don't care. You could be liberal. You could be left of center. No rational person is going to support watching what we saw last night on television, which was that was just worthless. I mean, it was absolutely pathetic, Barry.
Well, you're absolutely right. It ends up undermining their cause because it moves the center further away from what they believe in and alienates
That's
them
right.
from the center. The vast majority of the country are not anarchists and are not sympathetic with anarchy.
No, not at all. Not at all. And I think these people are hurting themselves more than anybody else. But then when you watch them talk and you watch some of the posters that they have, you have to wonder if they're even thinking. Anyway, probably not. We're going to take a little break, and when we come back, we'll get into a few more things with our friend Barry from the National Security Agenda. This is Silvio Canto in Dallas, Texas, and we're talking with our good friend Barry Jacobson. We're going to get into a little bit of the military operations that we saw this week in Yemen, in Somalia, an update in Iraq, and if there's anything new on the taking back of the city of Mosul. Barry, the operation in Yemen, did that happen? Was that decision made by President Trump, or was that something that had started under President Obama? Do you know?
Yes, it started under Obama. These operations take time to develop. While sometimes you get a kind of a snap decision to go in and do something because actionable intelligence, you know, hits your desk and you have to make a quick decision. Generally, these things are planned well in advance. My sources tell me that this planning began in October, so it was well underway before even before the election. Now, it may have been modified since as far as plans go, but in some embryonic form, it's been planned for some time.
Yeah. What exactly were these Navy SEALs, what was the objective of the operation in Yemen and in Somalia? Because they seem similar to me.
Well, in the case, first of all, one of the biggest problems we had with Barack Obama was using the overuse of drone attacks. As opposed to ground raids against terrorist targets. You can kill a terrorist pretty easily with a Hellfire missile, but you can't gather intelligence by killing them. The only way to gather intelligence and find out what they're planning so you can avoid the next attack is by either capturing them or capturing one of their computers and seeing what's on their hard drive. The raid into Yemen by SEAL Team 6, which is also called Naval Development Group, or DEVGRU. It's one of the two Tier 1 organizations we have in our military, the other one being the Army Delta Force, Operational Detachment Delta. But SEAL Team 6 went in there. They came in by Ospreys, as I understand it, and they were able to kill 14 of the terrorists. One of them was a leader. I'm not sure the leader's name. One of the leaders of Al Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, which is based out of Yemen. It's the same group that Al Awaki led before he was killed. And apparently, his daughter, 8-year-old daughter, might have been killed in the raid by accident, because it's right in the middle of a camp full of these people, including their women and children. And apparently, some of the women helped in the resistance against the SEALs and were killed in the firefight. But they succeeded in killing several of these guys, 14 some Al-Qaeda combatants, and they seized their hard drives, which we can then look at and gather operational intelligence. So this is a real improvement over what, even though it cost one of the lives of the soldiers, it's a real improvement over what we were doing with Obama. Can I say something else about something Sean Spicer
said
today?
Go ahead.
Sean Spicer was briefing about this, and he said something that I find mildly disturbing. He says, you hate to call, I'm almost quoting him, it's paraphrased, but it's close to what he said, is that you hate to call it a success when an American serviceman loses his life. That's, I understand where he's coming from. You certainly don't want to cheer when an American serviceman has been killed. And it's a micro tragedy, if you will, every time we lose anybody. But if you're going to say it's not a success if you lose anybody in an operation, if you can't take casualties, then by that definition, we've never had a military success in our history. I mean, we lost 4,000 troops landing on Omaha Beach. Are we going to say that the Normandy landings were a failure because we lost 4,000 men? Of course not. So we have to be clear about this. Any military operation, any kinetic military operation where you have boots on the ground and sometimes just even pilots overhead entails risk, and the risk is you may lose men. The other guy, the guy you're attacking, the guy you're fighting, they get a say too. You know, it's a two-way game. They get their time with the football. They get to run down the field and try to score also. Their bullets are indiscriminating. They go both directions, and these guys aren't supermen. They're good, but we're going to lose people from time to time. So we just got to be clear about that. We cannot be so casually averse that an operation this well-conducted is considered a failure if we lose one man.
Yeah. No, that's a very good point. I did not hear that, but I know exactly where you're coming from, because one of the things that many of our adversaries have always said is that we won't fight because we won't take casualties, which is of course not true. I mean, we took casualties in Iraq and other places, and we have to be willing to take casualties, and we have a volunteer army. These are people who volunteer to do these difficult jobs. So I hear what you're saying. But another interesting thing that General Flynn, getting back to him for a second, one of the interesting things that he said, not just him, but some of the people who were evaluating what he was saying, some of the pundits and so on the television, were saying that this is not only a message to Iran, but it was also a message to our allies that we are going to take Iran seriously, and we're going to hold them accountable for what's happening in Yemen and Somalia, where in a sense we're fighting proxy wars with Iran's proxies. Is that the right word? And so I think the message, you know, putting them on notice may have been a message not only to Iran, but some of our allies, Barry.
Yes, and by the way, I think one of the things Iran would like to see happen, and why they might have tried to attack that ship thinking it was an American frigate off that coast, because, again, right where they attacked another American frigate a few months ago, is they would like to see us get drawn into a ground war in Yemen against the Houthi rebels, which are a proxy militia operated by and controlled by Iran. Nothing would please them more than to have American guys there being shot at by the Houthis, and Iran, meanwhile, is taking no direct casualties. So I think we need to avoid that. Instead, we need to encourage the Saudis, who are already engaged against the Houthis, to continue those operations and support them any way we can.
Yeah. I remember one last thing, and then we'll go to the Russian tank article that you sent me. One last thing. I remember you bringing this up a few shows back. I think it was about the time that they were provoking us with these gunboats. One of the things you said back then that I always remembered was that Iran is, in fact, they want to fight with the United States. They actually do want to get into a war. And I remember you several months ago sort of repeating what you just said right now, that we have to be very careful where we get into a fight, because we don't want to get into a land war, let's say in Yemen or Somalia, where, I mean, it could go on for years, and they certainly have all the people they can, you know, they can lose a lot of people, but we are obviously a lot more thoughtful about casualties than they are, and I'm not even sure what objective there would be to get into a land war in Yemen. I mean, I don't know what's there to gain, Barry.
Well, you would get in there by accident because you're provoked. The way we got into Vietnam was, there's several reasons, but one of those things, if you remember, was the Gulf of Tonkin incident, in which supposedly American ship was attacked in the Gulf of Tonkin by North Vietnamese gunboats. So if you had a similar situation where Houthi rebels were able to damage or attack an American ship, you could see a scenario especially if you're an Iranian planner, where America might retaliate and land troops there to secure the coast, knock out targets in Yemen, and perhaps get caught in a sort of a quagmire. I don't think we're going to be stupid enough to do that. But Iran basically wants to get in a war with us that is to their advantage, obviously. And there's a couple scenarios where they could gain an advantage. One of those is a short, sharp shooting war in the Persian Gulf, in which they were able to, using whatever means, it could be a submarine quietly sitting at the bottom of the entrance to the Gulf, the Straits of Hormuz. It could be a land-based shore-to-ship missile based in Iranian land, Iranian mainland, but in some way inflict a catastrophic attack upon an American aircraft carrier, perhaps even sinking one. This would be catastrophic for the United States, and it would give Iran a huge feather in the cap, even if they lost every gunboat they've got, even if we heavily damaged some of their shore facilities, including the one that attacked us, from which they attacked us, or sunk the submarine that torpedoed our ship. To them, that's, and to the world, that's really a small ball, but sinking an American aircraft carrier, that hasn't happened since World War II. It's David and Goliath to a lot of the Third World, and Iran would come off looking, in their mind, very, very good as somebody has stood up to the United States and is able to, you know, pluck our beard. So that is a scenario they can win, and we got to be careful of. We cannot be in a position where we lose an aircraft carrier.
Right. Well, but I don't know. I'm not a military expert like you, but I would think that sinking an aircraft carrier is more than plucking my beard. I mean I think that President Jacobson would react very seriously if one of our aircraft carriers was attacked. Now, of course, that assumes that it was such a surprise attack. I know we've got all kinds of radars to prevent that from happening, but I would think there'd be some pretty tough public opinion back here if one of our aircraft carriers was attacked like that somewhere. I'm guessing.
Well,
I hope it doesn't happen.
If it was a premeditated attack and it came out of nowhere, it would have it'd be counterproductive for the Iranians because for exactly the reason you said, a surprise attack wouldn't work to their advantage. But if we were to get into a mild shooting war in the Gulf over gunboats attacking one of our destroyers, and it escalated into the scenario that I described earlier where we start sinking those gunboats, and then just one of those gunboats or again, a submarine or some other means, they actually hit an American aircraft carrier, then they could say they're being picked on by the United States, and they retaliated, defending themselves from Goliath, essentially, and they were able to then, you know, sink an aircraft carrier. That'd be much more effective for them from the standpoint of propaganda. They could say that we didn't really start the war, America started it, despite the fact they provoked it, and then they could say they retaliated and struck a massive blow by the grace of Allah against the infidel.
Wow. Well, that's a great point. I hadn't thought about that. That is a fabulous point. Now, you got me all excited this afternoon when you sent me this article about Russian tanks and a Russian tank war. And I want to give it a good bit of time today. Tell me about that. I thought it was a fascinating article, Barry, as well as the other one you sent about the weapons. So I don't know if those two are tied together or if you which one you want to do first.
Well, they are tied together. What the article was about was apparently there was some investigation into what the Russians were up to conducting operations in the Donbass region, which is to say the eastern part of the Ukraine. And this article had to do with Lieutenant General McMaster, who is a big part of our planning for the future wars. And he was talking about the next generation of Russian warfare and how it could lead to a one-sided, or at least a lopsided, battle between us and the Russians and Europe that might not come out to our advantage. And the reason being is the Russians have spent a lot of time, a lot of energy in the last 10 years basically modernizing their equipment in ways that we haven't. We've been concentrating on counterterrorism while they've been concentrating on their conventional forces. And we've really let a lot of our capabilities decay. You could say from 1980 until probably at least 2003 or four, certainly through the 90s, that the United States had the best armored fighting forces in the world. We had the best tank, the M1 Abrams. The Bradley fighting vehicle was superb. We had the best artillery systems. Of course, we've always dominated the air since World War II. So American commanders never had to look up and worry that what they're hearing screeching overhead might be dropping bombs on them. That hasn't happened since the Second World War. But all that could be changing. The Russians have first-generation tanks that are probably superior, all said and done, to what we have. They have planes that can match us in many ways. They have superb anti-aircraft systems. But what the article points out is that they've really improved their electronic warfare capability. Missiles fired by the Ukrainians against Russian tanks report zero hits on the Russian T-90. Not a single one was knocked out for two reasons. One, because they have a very highly advanced reactive armor system where if an incoming shell hits the tank, the armor of the tank itself reacts by blasting outwards, stopping the blast of the incoming shell and killing it. They also have rounds that fire outwards, much like the phalanx cannon system on a ship, where a Gatling gun blasts an incoming missile out of the sky. They have similar systems to that. They have counter-missile missiles and knock missiles out, but more importantly, against anti-tank missiles fired by infantrymen, like our TOWS, for instance. They have electronic systems that completely script the guidance system. So one tanker was saying he had fired a shell, a missile actually, out of his tank gun at a Russian T-90, and as it approached the T-90, it took a 90-degree turn and went shooting straight up into the air, completely jammed and sent haywire by the Russian electronic jamming system. So that's pretty scary in and of itself, that they may have a tank that we don't have the means to kill. We have really let that capability go. Now, what would we have to use this? Well, the probably most likely scenario would be if the Russians attacked into the Baltic states. It's unlikely we put tanks and troops into the Ukraine, though I think it is likely we give the Ukrainians a much better capability to defend themselves under Trump than Obama did. But the Baltic states, as we've talked about before, are NATO members. We've recently, in the last two summers, been holding extensive war games, NATO has been, in the United States, envisioning a scenario where the Russians invade the Baltics, and we have to reinforce the Baltic states through Poland. Russians have a large military base at Kaliningrad, which is used to be called Konigsberg. It's around the Baltic Sea, and it's right there at the geographical joint between the Baltic states and Poland. That's a Russian fortress. And fighting could break out, if we had to fight to defend the Baltic states, fighting could break out at Kaliningrad and the surrounding area in what used to be called East Prussia. Now it's North Poland. And it could break out right in the Baltic states like Estonia, in which American armored columns could have to fight Russian tanks. So that's pretty scary. It's not the only thing, though. One last thing, because I know you want to jump in here, but one last thing is the Russians also have improved artillery tremendously. Apparently, in a single salvo by Russian artillery against Ukrainian, two Ukrainian mechanized battalions, we're talking over 1,000 men, and probably anywhere from 30 to 60 vehicles, or perhaps even more. I don't know the TOE of the Ukrainian mech battalion, but we're talking about a lot of armored vehicles. In just one salvo, 3-minute salvo, they wiped out the entire two battalions. And the way they're doing it is with multiple launch rocket systems. We have the same sort of capability, but theirs are an interesting mix of thermobaric munitions, kind of the fuel air bomb sort of thing you probably have heard of, and then precision-guided anti-tank weapons. And they can apparently plaster the battlefield with these things, including some of the launch drones at a very high altitude out of these multiple launch rocket systems, and the drones themselves attack the tanks and armored vehicles. But if they can wipe out two entire battalions in a matter of minutes with a single salvo, that's a pretty scary capability.
Yeah, I would think so. A couple of things came to my mind. The first one was, how much is the collapse of NATO as a fighting force, meaning the fact, I don't mean us or the British or the Canadians who are, you know, the ones that were doing the actual fighting in Afghanistan, but I'm saying some of the other countries, because for a long time, that's what I thought NATO was for, to stop Russian tanks or Warsaw Pact tanks from going west. So this problem that you're identifying right now, the fact that the Russians are, you know, as you say, ahead of us, is that a consequence of the collapse of NATO? That's my first question. Second question is somewhat related, and that is, there was a time in the Middle East where we could test Soviet weapons by giving our weapons to the Israelis, and then they would use them against Soviet weapons, let's say, being used by whatever the other country was, Syria, whatever the other country was. We haven't had a chance to do that in a long time, Barry, to go one-on-one with, well, then Soviet, now Russian weapons. So we haven't had a chance to really test them as we did, let's say, 1982 or other times when the Israelis would just wipe out these countries that had Soviet equipment. So a couple of questions there about what you were saying. I don't know if I make any sense, but hopefully you understood my questions.
Yeah, well, let's start with the last one first. Then I'm going to have to have you remind me of the second one. But the point about testing weapons. During the Cold War, which lasted from the late 40s all the way through the beginning of the 1990s, I think the Berlin Wall came down in 1989, was it, 1990? So the Cold War lasted
for a long
time. Yeah, 89.
In the fall of 89, so, yeah.
During those years, we never directly engaged the Russians, but instead we fought proxy wars against their allies and they against ours. And particularly in the Middle East, we had each other's proxies fighting each other. Our proxy was, and our ally was Israel. Their allies and proxies were pretty much every other Arab nation. Iran was, until 1979, was also one of our allies under the Shah. And we would supply ours with our equipment, and they'd supply their proxies with their equipment. So it was a good test, if not of expertise, at least of the equipment of the two superpowers. And in most of those battles, we came out the better. And then we were able to identify flaws or strengths in the Soviet weaponry. Well, that doesn't exist anymore. The Soviets don't have any proxies that we're fighting anymore, and that hasn't been the case since the Cold War. So a lot of this equipment we're seeing them test on the Chechens, where they were able to level Grozny in Chechnya with thermobaric weapons. We're seeing it in Syria, and we're seeing it in the Donbass. So it's no longer against our weapons, but it's against we at least get to see their weapons being tested. What was the first question?
Well, the first question was about NATO. That I always understood that was the whole point of NATO, to have these tanks, not just American tanks. Well, they could be American-made, but they would be run by other NATO personnel. And with the collapse of NATO as a fighting force, I mean, the other countries that just don't have any fighting force, it puts NATO at a disadvantage at a time when Russia didn't stop building, Barry.
Yeah, NATO still exists on paper, and to some limited extent it still has a military capability. It's nothing like it was during the Cold War, just like we are nothing like we were during the Cold War. At the time of the Cold War, from the Baltic Sea to the Adriatic, there was a potential wall of troops. A large number were American, a large number were European. NATO, of which there's 26 members, still spends a bit on defense, but for the most part, they've gone from being a military establishment, on top of the various European countries, have gone from providing a real military establishment that could fight wars, even defensive ones, to a little more than a home militia. They've taken all the money they should be spending on ground troops, on modernizing systems, and providing NATO with a robust capability. They've taken all that money and put it into social programs. Germany had to absorb, at the time of unification, at the end of the Cold War, they had to absorb the entire eastern part of Germany, which was in really deplorable condition. much of Eastern Germany had not been rebuilt since World War II. You had a huge number of East Germans coming to, they were now needing social services and lots of infrastructure building. So Germany turned its military spending, it's turned its guns into butter. They turned their swords into plowshares. So when Donald Trump says that NATO is not doing its fair share, he's absolutely correct. The NATO nations are not living up to the treaty obligation to spend a certain amount on their gross domestic product, their budget, on military spending.
That's right.
That said, though, Europe, if it was united on an operation, if NATO was united on an operation, and the United States was willing to get in there with both feet, we could deter the Russians probably over time. We certainly can keep the Russians from invading Western Europe. They're not going to invade even into Central Europe. But when you get on the periphery, when you get up to areas like the Baltic states, when you get over to Ukraine, the center of mass is closer, the center of gravity of the battle is closer to them than it is us. And I mean, German supply lines are longer than theirs. Their supply lines are short. It makes it much more problematic. So fighting a battle in the Baltic states is a lot tougher for us than it is them.
Right. No, this is a fascinating point. I really would like to come back to this whole topic at another time, because it's, I think, a threat that we need to start taking very seriously. My guess is that people like Mathis and Trump and Flynn are taking it very seriously. That's just my sense. I think these are the kinds of people that look down the road and see threats like these. Barry, as always, I want to thank you for your time. Just a quick heads up, what's our next World War II show?
I think next week we're talking about the Battle of Midway, which was the turning point in the Pacific.
Right, exactly, the Battle of Midway, one of my favorite topics. So we're going to get into that next week. As always, thank you for your time. Go ahead.
Before we go, can I just remind us, this is too early in our World War II presentation to talk about it now, but because we haven't got that far into war in Europe. But today is the anniversary of the surrender of Stalingrad. The Battle of Stalingrad ended on this day in 1942.
I saw that. I saw that in the history.com website. I think I sent you a post about that as well. You're right. And that we'll get into that, because that was a very costly war for the Germans. And it's an interesting point now that you bring this up. We have some friends in Austria who visited the United States a few years ago, and we spent some time with them. And they were telling us, somehow we started talking about Russia and World War II, and they were telling us that many of the young boys, young men who died in Stalingrad were actually Austrian born, that they were actually Austrian young men who were part of were put in the German army, and that there are cemeteries in Stalingrad of just full of graves of Austrians. And they told me about that. I didn't know that angle of the story there.
Well, I didn't either, but it's not surprising considering that the Anschluss, which meant the unification of Germany with Austria, occurred in 1934 or 1936, I think it was 1936. And so the Austrians became part of Greater Germany, and so their manpower was then added to Germany's as part of the German Wehrmacht.
It was a fascinating story that this couple was telling us, and something that I was completely unaware of. I mean, one of those things where you just learn something new and you want to ask a lot of questions about it. But they say that there are people in Austria who literally go to, I guess it's St. Petersburg now, right? And actually go there.
No, it's now Volgograd.
They literally go there. You know, people from Austria actually go there to see the graves of their relative, maybe their grandfather or whatever, who's buried there. And it's an amazing angle to this World War II story. Well, we'll pick it up next week at the Battle of Midway.
We will indeed, and look forward to it. And thanks again for having me on your show.
Listen, it's always a great pleasure. How's the weather in San Antonio? I mean, in San Diego, probably perfect, I would think. Oops, I think we lost Barry. I was going to ask him what the weather was like in San Diego, because I'm sure it's perfect. It always is. It's
not that that nice here. It's a little chilly here in Dallas. But thank you. Thank you, Barry Jacobson, for joining us. It's always a treat to have you on the show, and thank you for listening. And we'll talk to you later.